for me to kind of hone in on like what makes the fungal world that I created good, I needed to understand like what are narrative structures that I could apply to this that could ground people in the familiarity of genre, the familiarity of genres that they understand and have expectations of in terms of the beats that they hit or the tropes that they play into, and use that to ground them in the reality of this world, but then consistently draw them deeper into the unsettling and the unfamiliar and the things that could very easily pull a reader out of a story. But if it's done in such a way where there's a good balance between the unfamiliar and the familiar, then I could do a much better job of keep the momentum of the story going while kind of like hitting those beats and microdosing the reader with world and character and the sort of strangeness of this setting.
Everybody, you are listening to episode 97 of SFF Addicts. I am your host for today, MJ Kuhn. So welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Again, as you have noticed, since I'm not Adrian, we have a different episode style today because my lovely co-pilot is our wonderful guest again this week. Yes, because we are on part two of our chat with Adrian, celebrating the release, last week's release of his debut novel, Mushroom Blues, which is a beautiful cyberpunky noir detective mushroom drenched, beautiful romp, with a wonderful message. So
beautiful
pick
romp.
It up.
I love that.
It's a beautiful romp. It's got a wonderful message. It's got great characters and a very rich and loamy world. God. It's great. As well, a quick note for everybody out there, if you're listening or watching, our SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check out the links in the description, find out what cool goodies that you can get from subscribing to our Patreon, and, you know, support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the show on your favorite podcast application, and subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel, where this and every other episode is available in full video. And now, joining me again is my lovely co-host, Adrian M. Gibson, author of the recently released Mushroom Blues. Hot seat, Adrian. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very, very happy to hang out with you. And I also just want to, because you're hosting, I just want to shout out to my girls' books as well. these beauties right here. The Blue Baby.
Yes.
Among Thieves.
The Blue Baby.
The Green Baby. Everyone's probably missing the babies. Where are my babies
the
at?
The babies. Yes, check out my babies too. But here, we're here today to talk about Adrian's baby.
My gross little fungal baby.
Yes, your gross fungal baby. Your firstborn book baby. So as a heads up, this is part two of my two-part chat with Adrian. So I recommend checking out part one to get the scoop, the inside scoop on Mushroom Blues, how it came to be, and get to know him even better than you already might from being a listener of the show. But today, we're doing the mash, the genre mash.
Dude.
Did the mash. Right? Thank you. I was proud of that one.
Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts.
So, to kick off this conversation that I think is going to be really fun about genre mashups, what is the first time you remember being struck by a genre mashup in a story that you saw or read something and you were like, oh, holy shit, this is two things in one?
That's a very difficult question. Because I think a lot of what I read as a kid was like genre mashups. Last episode, I mentioned Lemony Snicket, A Series of Unfortunate Events. And I feel like every one of those books is, obviously it's like set in sort of this like fantasy alt reality kind of thing. But each one was approaching the story in a different way, with a different setting and with recurring characters and everything. But at the same time, what these kids had to go through, the shit that they endured
every single time. The unfortunate events, a whole series of them.
Unfortunate events, yeah. All of those unfortunate events. We're bringing in different genres, even within single books. And then Redwall as well. I wouldn't necessarily call it a genre mashup, but the ways in which anthropomorphized animals were blended with fantasy really stood out to me as like, whoa, I've never experienced this before. Like animals that talk and the sort of like culture and society that they have and the food that they eat was for me just so...
Such good food.
Captivating. It's such good food, man. Such good food. There's such cool animals.
Quick sidebar on Redwall food. There is literally a Twitter account that is Redwall Feastbot. And it tweets out quotes from Redwall books describing the feasts. And I've followed it for years. Yeah. Anyways.
But I don't think I realized what genre mashups were for a very long time. But you know, as I got older and I started to watch shows like Buffy or like my older brothers like have me watch The X-Files far too young.
Oh, but
there were ways in which like The X-Files was mashing up genres episode to episode, or Buffy was, you know, blending urban fantasy with horror and you know, both of those shows I think even had like musical episodes, which for me was like, what the fuck
sure.
is going
I think
on?
Buffy yeah. did for sure, at least.
Yeah, X-Files did as well. X-Files did as well. So it was cool to be able to kind of see that genre was and always will be flexible as opposed to restrained.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things I think that does make it tricky, because when you're talking about like the stuff we consumed as a kid, we weren't really necessarily aware of genre at that point.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like you kind of were, but it's like, you know, you weren't thinking about it in that way. And I think maybe that's a fun like first little, I don't know, nugget for this episode, is that it's the genre mash is about you know, kind of regaining that childlike engagement mm-hmm. with fiction, where it's more about just the story and engaging with it regardless of genre. And, you know, we don't have to be so narrow. Everything can be fun, especially in SFF. I think it's very blendable. Yeah. But I want to talk about Mushroom Blues to start, because Mushroom Blues is clearly a genre mash. That's why we're talking about it with you here. So for anyone that hasn't read it yet, first off, what are you doing? Go pause this episode. Go read Mushroom Blues. Then replay it starting here. No. But Mushroom Blues pause is a really great mashup.
Pause your life.
And yeah, do pause that, right? Everything. Take a day off work. No. So it's got this like really cool like crime noir elements. It's got very cool kind of sci-fi cyberpunky elements, and then it's got this whole interesting mushroom element that is, you know, is its own thing altogether. Did you know when you were going into writing Mushroom Blues, did you know for sure you wanted to make it a genre mashup? Did it just kind of happen as the story took shape? Like, how did that come about for you?
So I mentioned it last episode, but the kind of formation of the Fungalverse and how this world I'd spent so much time building but never writing anything meaningful in, the critical moment was when I realized, like, this isn't working because I'm confining myself to this idea of a travelogue in this fantasy fungal world. But when I took that fungal world and kind of ditched the rest, I realized, okay, these are the genres that I love. And how cool would it be, you know, like reading stuff like Finch by Jeff Vandermeer. That for me is like OG fungal punk, you know? That is fungal noir in this fantasy world, but it's so rooted in like the kind of noir aesthetic and the noir beats. But then so much of what's around it was just eerie and surreal. And for me to kind of hone in on like what makes the fungal world that I created good, I needed to understand like what are narrative structures that I could apply to this that could ground people in the familiarity of genre. The familiarity of genres that they understand and have expectations of in terms of the beats that they hit or the tropes that they play into, and use that to ground them in the reality of this world, but then consistently draw them deeper into the unsettling and the unfamiliar and the things that could very easily pull a reader out of a story. But if it's done in such a way where there's a good balance between the unfamiliar and the familiar, then I could do a much better job of keep the momentum of the story going while kind of like hitting those beats and microdosing the reader with world and character and the sort of strangeness of this setting. And so I was very, very conscious from the beginning of Mushroom Blues, because I'd already done it with Spore City, just with different genre beats and different sort of mashups, and figuring out like, how can I use this framework to make Mushroom Blues like a tight noir police procedural mystery, but then bring in the fungal punk and just really embrace it to the point where so much of the world and the story and the characters is fully integrated into that. But the beats of noir, the beats of murder mystery, are still so present and so identifiable that those can kind of be the lodestone for the reader throughout the process.
Yeah, absolutely. When, you know, it's so funny when you're mentioning how that happened, where you had this giant world that you'd built and you were, you know, pursuing this travelogue, and then you when it actually clicked is when you decided to shift gears and do a genre mashup. And it's so funny because I didn't realize it until literally this very moment. That's exactly what happened with me with Among Thieves, because the world of Timur was from a totally different project that didn't work. And when I decided to mash it with crime fiction and a heist is when it clicked, which is fun.
Nice.
But so, as you mentioned, I mean, it's the whole noir thing, but it's a murder mystery. It's very much the beats of the story are very similar to crime procedural kind of vibe. So I have to know, what are some of your favorite crime procedurals? Like, were there any that particularly inspired you for Mushroom Blues, and what drew you to that genre in particular?
I'll start with the latter part first, because I've always loved sort of like mysteries, and again, I was introduced to them way too young. Like, I probably watched the movie Seven when I was fucking seven. This is the benefit of having three older brothers. My oldest brother is like 10 years older than me, so there's such
disassociation. Oh my god, and especially you were seven, he was 17, the perfect age for being a shithead.
So I watched like the X-Files far too early, but I love the X-Files for its kind of, it is very much like a police procedural, even though it's more like a government agency, but it does have its roots in that. Seven is like a masterpiece in my mind. Season one of True Detective was hugely inspirational for the kind of like twisting, mind-bendy mystery, but also the relationship between these two cops and the ways in which it was so fragmented and challenging for them, and the mood and atmosphere of it is just brilliant. But then I also really love going back and sort of like the noir tradition to read, you know, like classics by Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, to read Agatha Christie mysteries as well. I was just like, I love them. And I think film noir is what really captured me, like Blade Runner, which is on the sci-fi end of film noir. But then movies like Chinatown, and then crime thriller movies like The Godfather or Casino, and like the ways in which crime thrillers started to incorporate stories about like gangsters and gang families and all this kind of stuff. I just love it. Like there's so much room for exploration of the human condition and human nature in terms of being presented with challenging characters who are doing things that we find despicable, but it's like a car crash. There's like the horror and the aversive nature of these things are just impossible to look away from. You're just drawn to it. And I've always found the relationship between like police and crime to be a very interesting dynamic. And I think what has come out of that, even with TV shows like, you know, The Wire and Bones and what else, like NCIS and CSI and all these different shows that really captured I think some of them lean farther away from believability, especially when you start getting into like CSI territory. But there is something captivating.
10,000.
Yeah, exactly. Criminal Minds as well. Like Criminal Minds is very much of that. But there's just something so captivating about the ways in which crime and a murder or a murder mystery and how that unfolds, the ways in which clues are pieced together has always been the thing that really caught me, because the mystery is so strong and the ways in which the clues kind of emerge over the course of the story is like the perfect addictive cocktail for a narrative to be like, you know, curiosity and the necessity for the viewer or the reader, whoever, to just need to know, what is this? What is the truth about this thing? How did this happen? Who did it? For me, it is just so engaging to have that question present in your mind and to receive little nuggets along the way that bring clarity or sometimes misdirect. But the ability for these genres to kind of like tap into the psychology of people is just so, so potent. And I've been a fan of it because I've fallen into that sort of trap of what that narrative is trying to do and how it succeeds convinced me that like, I love watching and reading these stories. Like, why not create my own?
Absolutely. Well, and that's, I mean, we were talking about it the other day when I was texting you while I was reading Mushroom Blues, where I was like, oh my God, I'm loving these little breadcrumbs that I'm picking up on. And like, I do think there is something very addictive about it for a certain personality type that I think is a lot of readers, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, I'm one of those people, I want to guess every plot twist in any book before it happens. And that is doubly true if it's a mystery story, right? Like I used to, when you just mentioned Bones, I used to be a huge fan of Bones, like back in its heyday. I remember, fun fact, like, oh, and I got my wisdom teeth out right after high school, and I laid on the couch and I watched Bones on DVD. This was the days before Netflix. I'm aging myself here for like... a full week. but it was, you know, Bones, it was a thing.
Didn't Bones have a musical episode as well?
Probably.
I don't know why that was a thing.
It's a thing, right? For every show, especially like in that like, it's like mid-2000s.
If you like surpass, like, yeah. If you surpass like fucking 10 seasons, like we'll just give you a musical right? episode.
You get a musical episode. You get a musical episode and you get a musical episode. But yeah, it was always fun to try to figure out, you know, to try to solve the mystery before the crew did, right? Yeah. And I think that is a very fun thing. And it's a tricky thing to pull off, which you have and in Mushroom Blues. It's fantastic to lay the right number of breadcrumbs where it's possible to figure it out, but it's not obvious. And I love that. I love that. I want to talk about other genre mashups a little bit, though.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're talking, we've seen this the sci-fi mashed with the, you know, the kind of crime procedural murder mystery. And I think we've, you know, you see that in a few other places, right? Like a comp that I list for Mushroom Blues, right, would tell people. Alter Carbon, I think, is a mm-hmm. good one, right? Where it is, it's sci-fi and it's that crime procedural. Or like, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the fantasy heist thing, right? You see that in Lies of Locke Lamora, Six of Crows, Among Thieves. But, you know, so there's a few that we've seen. What are some genre mashups you'd love to see more of? And are there any that you think are kind of played out for you?
I mean, there are some that I've just like never even delved into. Like romanticy does not appeal to me at all. Yeah, but I understand why.
Oh, I get the appeal. It's just not my vibe. Yeah.
But one that I would like to see more of is, we talked to Chloe Gong a couple months ago. I loved the way that she approached in her series, or in her duology, like Foul Heart. What is it? Foul Lady Fortune and Foul Heart Huntsman.
Heart Huntsman, yeah.
Those two books and the way it kind of mashes up this like sort of historically based Shanghai, but it's not like super fantasy in any way, but it's like that mashup of Cold War spy thrillers with fantasy or sci-fi. Robert Jackson Bennett does it brilliantly in his Divine Cities trilogy with City of Stairs and its sequels, where it's like this really rich fantasy world based on like Eastern Europe, but it's a Cold War spy thriller series. And that really plays into like authors that I love, like John Le Carré and like his Cold War thrillers, like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy or The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. I adore that. And like, I want to see more of that dynamic kind of brought into more fantasy and sci-fi. I'm trying to think of anything else. That one is the strongest for me. Cause I feel like there are a lot of like detective mysteries that are in fantasy and sci-fi. You know, like there are a lot of romance plots and subplots infused into mystery and sci-fi. Heists has become much bigger, and I love when heists are incorporated into anything. like crime thrillers and how that blends into it as well. I don't know if you can think of anything that you'd want to see more of.
Yeah, well, when you're just talking about it, I mean, I know it's more of like a, I don't know, a setting thing. And that's actually a question that I want us to talk about next or later, whatever, at some point in this episode. but like when you'd mentioned like the whole like 60s, like spy, you know, Cold War spy vibe, I feel like there's just kind of a, at least that I have not seen. I'm sure it is out there, but I haven't seen a ton of fantasy or, you know, whatever. Is it sci-fi? Whatever. We'll call it sci-fi. stuff that is kind of, you see a lot of fantasy stuff that is set in a world analogous to medieval times, sword and sorcery. Mm-hmm. Yes, medieval Europe is the most common, but now we're getting a lot more different cultures, which is fun. But still from that kind of like sword wielding phase of time. And then you get kind of some flintlock stuff, which is maybe like based on the 19th,
like the, yeah, like Napoleonic era and stuff like that.
But you don't get a ton from like the 50s forward, right, where it's still not, until you hit urban fantasy, right, where it's you know, kind of the modern age of fantasy. And that's kind
of, you want to know one of the best examples of that? The Fallout video game series.
Ooh, yes.
How that basically uses an apocalyptic event as a full stop on society's advancement. So the fact that it was like, it happened in the 50s, everything that is in this future post-apocalypse is representative of that era. Even though it's like just the remnants of it, it still comes through so strong in terms of like the music and the cars and the aesthetics. And I think that is really, really well done. Because like
that genre retrofuturism, right?
Yeah, retrofuturism. Like genre mashups don't have to necessarily be confined to narrative structures. It can also be heavily influenced by a milieu or sort of like aesthetics of an era. And Fallout is a particular example where the aesthetics are actually very deeply integrated into the world and the story, as opposed to aesthetics that could be more set dressing and just feel kind of weak and unnecessary.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what is the weirdest genre mashup you can think of that you have seen or haven't seen. I'm thinking like a romance horror. Is that out there? Is that a thing? Have you seen
probably,
that?
Probably.
Right? There's
one genre mashup that I really love. So it's Khan Wong's debut novel, The Circus Infinite, is like...
I've not read that.
It's like... It's space. It's science fantasy, more like space fantasy.
Okay.
But mashed up with sort of like a circus setting, like with like acrobatics and the people who are involved in the circus, which feels like so out of place from like a sci-fi or like, you know, far future distant galaxy kind of vibe. But to have this like very strong, I would say like mid 20th century or early 20th century circus aesthetic brought into a space fantasy world was really, really well done. So I think like that kind of thing is so cool because it's representative of Khan's personal life and the things that he's done, and like, you know, skills he has, like, you know, he's, I can't remember exactly what it is, but he's like a performing artist.
Oh, he's like acrobatics or something? Like
no, I don't think acrobatics, but like, okay. I can't remember exactly what it is, but some involvement in performing arts. And so it's like, he took that background and brought it into the Circus Infinite. And there are just so many ways in which writers can utilize their diverse passions and allow that to also be a part of the mashup. So I think it kind of goes beyond genre, you know, like genre mashups are a thing, but I also think it can be mashups of a broader context and a broader collection of that particular author's interests and skills. And in, you know, like in my case, mushrooms are not a genre.
Yeah, but that's, I was trying to like describe it where I'm like, and then also, but it's such an integral part of the vibe, and vibe is like so strongly tied to genre generally, right? Yeah, I love that. Well, and that's, I mean, that just made me think of a book that I recently read this year that was probably one of the craziest genre mashups, Light from Uncommon Stars. I don't know if you've read that one yet.
Yep.
It's, yeah, so for listeners, it's
Rika
Aoki, yeah. The story is a violin teacher that sold her soul to the devil and has to, like, give the souls of students over, which, so we've already got, like, music plus, like, kind of dark fantasy, but then there's space aliens, right? So it's like, wait, so, and, yeah, it's kind of fun.
But can I quickly interject? There's one author who has done an amazing job. He's not alive anymore, but Ian M. Banks, his Culture series was so good at blending space opera with basically like this like post-scarcity galactic civilization, which is like so advanced that artificial intelligences are able to run the basically like run the institutions that keep this civilization going and allow humans to do things that the time wasted on whatever the AI is doing gives them more time for creative endeavors and all kinds of different things. But obviously
it's supposed to be for, not the everyone's using it for in this horrible real world.
So that framework sounds quite, you know, optimistic and utopian, but there are multiple ways in which Ian M. Banks used that framework and infused other genres into it in order to create conflict in very interesting ways. And so every single book that he wrote was bringing in different genres, but also bringing in different sort of like interests and passions that really brought richness to the worlds. Like he has one called The Hydrogen Sonata, which is all, it's like kind of a mystery based around music. Or there's like the first book is called Consider Phlebas. And that one is actually kind of like a Cold War spy thriller, but a space opera at the same time. There's one called The Player of Games, which is like, it really reminds me of Queen's Gambit, and it's just brilliant the way that he uses that to create stakes where someone would say like, hey, like, let's write a whole book based around this, like this game, you know, like chess, for instance. But you look at something like Queen's Gambit or you look at Player of Games, and both of them are just unbelievably well told. And so much tension that it is possible for authors to bring these things into the fold and allow them to be foundational for their story and for their world and not have it be boring. The only thing that will make it boring is if you predetermine that it's going to be boring. In which case, you're not,
bored as the author.
If you're, yeah, in which case, either it's not worth doing because you don't know how to make it interesting, or it's just, you're not fucking trying hard enough.
Work harder. That's the, no. Work harder, man. You brought up something, cause I have recently been reading The Expanse for the first time. I actually just finished it this week. So you gotta finish book 9 so we can talk about it.
And we talked about this in the playlist, but yeah.
We did. But, you know, you had brought up at that time something that kind of blew my mind about it that I hadn't noticed, but had really taken in, you know, just as I was taking in the story, is that really each book in The Expanse kind of is a different genre mashup, right? Mm-hmm. Where the book one is very much space opera meets crime noir. Book two is almost like horror.
But I would call it like a military thriller with like
military thriller. Meets space opera, right? So I think that's kind of a fun thing that, you know, even within the same series, as with the previous example with Euron Banks, you don't have to pick one mashup, right? You can
for the whole thing, right?
There's so much room to play, especially, I mean, probably in genres outside of SFF, but definitely within SFF to kind of, you know, mix and match and play.
Can I give you an example from, so I mentioned the Kanoko trilogy last episode. So Spore City is the start of that. That one is very much a mashup of different things, but at its core, it's like cyberpunk through the lens of fungi and, you know, bringing in like corporate espionage and kind of like gangster crime families and that crime thriller aspect. Book two in that series, that one is going to be more of like a political thriller centered around an election. And then book three is just going to up the stakes even further. And it's going to be much more of like a military thriller with very kind of like expansive scope. And so it's like the scope increases and the genre mashups change depending on the context of that particular story. So it's kind of like this escalation from like local and growing larger and larger, but also how genre is able to come together in different ways to allow that expanding scope to encompass sort of a more effective projection of its ideas through the use of particular genres. So it's like military thrillers are very good at providing broader scope. Political thrillers are very good at having an event be like the loci of that particular story and having so much stuff revolve around it. And in Spore City, it's like the three different POVs each kind of have their own genre mashups going on in and of themselves. But it's very much localized, you know, kind of like within Neo Kanoko.
Oh my God. I'm so excited for this series because you're speaking my language. Like, I love me a military thriller, military sci-fi, military space opera, whatever. I love that. I love political intrigue and espionage. Oh my God. Okay. I'm so excited for this series. Let's get off the air so you can write faster. No, I'm just kidding.
I haven't even released my book yet. Right? At least when we record
this. Yes, you have. We're talking in the future now.
Past, future, whatever the fuck.
Yeah, past, future, whatever the weird concept is. So here's kind of a broad question. What is the difference, or is there a difference? Because this was something I was kind of running up against and running into when I was crafting the questions for this interview. What's the difference, or is there a difference between a genre mashup and a subgenre? Are they the same? Are they different? Let's chat it out.
I think a lot of subgenres start out as genre mashups. Like, take cozy fantasy, for instance.
Yeah.
That was, you know, different. That was a case where different authors were wanting to, and cozy mystery even as well, which is also a subgenre, where it's kind of like localizing the setting and bringing the stakes, not necessarily bringing the stakes down, but creating stakes out of seemingly more mundane things.
Yeah, it's almost like a mashup of like contemporary and fantasy, but not making it urban fantasy. You know what I mean?
And so in the case of like cozy fantasy, it's like, how can we make something that is much more localized and much more endearing while retaining, you know, tension in certain ways. But the tension is kind of shifted towards things like relationships. The conflict and the stakes are shifted from things like the world is going to end to like, is she going to open up this coffee shop? You know?
Right.
And Cozy Mysteries is kind of the same thing, where it's like the enemy, the kind of antagonists in a cozy mystery are not, you know, going to murder the entire world, or they're not going to like kill an entire, they're not going to blow up an entire city or anything like that. It's like kind of like Clue. It's like confining the setting and the amount of characters in such a way where the reduction in density of information and people and things that are going on is actually evocative of the feeling of coziness. So it's like the genre itself, the ways in which it mashes up fantasy or mystery or whatever with this notion of being cozy and not being inundated with anxiety, that has the power to just become its own subgenre. And so I think like so many of these subgenres just started out as mashups, and they resulted in trends that became a defined thing. And usually that definition comes from booksellers or publishers or people who want to approach it from a marketability and economic standpoint. So even though these subgenres are just mashups,
yeah,
but they are mashups that have reached a pinnacle of sort of broader consciousness, such that institutions have put a label on it so that they can market it and sell it more effectively. So like Romantasy is a prime example of that.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably been the quintessential example, yeah, right?
There has been romance in fantasy for a long time, but it reached a sort of critical mass moment where publishers realize like, we can really fucking work it off. We can like really make money off of this. How many more like Sarah J. Masses can we find? Like how many new series can we sign and publish?
How many more book talk sensations can we find?
Exactly. just peruse TikTok and like half of those, like probably 80% of those fail. But the permeability of something like Put a Label on Romantasy, that's the kind of thing that can become viral. And most people don't realize that this started out as just like a mashup of different genres that people were fascinated enough to smash together. But it is kind of crazy that, you know, every genre that exists outside of like the broad categories of science fiction and fantasy and horror or whatever, the more refined you get, things like grimdark, for instance, that is like a mashup, not of genre necessarily, but of fantasy and mood.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's kind of like that element of vibe that we, for lack of a better word, that we're all about the vibes today. We're all about the vibes. Yeah.
But that's one of the coolest things I think is that it doesn't have to be. I mentioned it before. It doesn't have to be confined to genre specifically. Grimdark emerged out of a combination of fantasy and mood, you know, with like George R. R. Martin and Joe Abercrombie, I think, was like the author that helped
Lord Grimdark genre. Himself. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though he just jokes about that. He was
Twitter handle.
He was the author that helped that genre reach the critical mass point where the marketers picked up on, we can label this and we can turn it into a subgenre. And so I think it is really fascinating how, you know, the creative side of things can really bring out the most intense focus from the publishing side of things, or the marketing side of things, like the booksellers and all these people who are basically have a financial incentive in what's going on in the book world. And it's like something that we've talked about with people in the past, like Chelsea Abdullah, the difference between like a creative pursuit and a project morphing into a product.
Yeah.
And I think
I genre, do remember it, when she said product yeah. or project to product. And I was like, yeah. Oh my God, that's such a and good way to put it. Yeah.
Genre is a very strong reflection of how the passion of creativity can become morphed into the labeling of a product, because these products need to be labeled in order to give people a general idea of what it's about, of what they can expect. And I think the worst thing for readers is when the projected expectation, whether it's like the synopsis or the genre that it's marketed under, when that expectation fails to hit, is when a reader is either most pissed off or most disappointed, most likely to DNF, most likely to one star, or even return the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about making sure you're sticking true to those reader expectations. I mean, obviously we want to subvert expectations in ways that keep things exciting, but to your point, you need to stay true to the core of the genre in to some extent, right? And I think that's probably one of the biggest struggles that a writer could face when pursuing a genre mashup, because you need to stick to not only the core of one genre, but two or more, while also creating something completely new and, you know, kind of turning things on their head, but in a way that feels satisfying to the reader. What are some of your tips, or at least, you know, something that you pursued when you were writing Mushroom Blues? You know, did you, how did tropes come into it, maybe leaning on, you know, certain things to keep the heart of what you were looking to do while also expanding and creating something new?
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with the fact that I chose genres that I am a massive fan of.
Yeah.
I think if you consume enough of any particular genre or subgenre, you start to become familiar, either consciously or subconsciously, of the tropes and the beats that exist within that. So it's like romance has very defined, well-defined beats, and reader expectations are rooted in what they've consumed before. And so for me, having consumed so much crime thrillers, murder mysteries, noir, police procedurals, I knew that there are things that I had to hit, beats that I had to hit, because they are beats that I love and I'm familiar with.
Yeah, that you're looking for, right? Yeah, when you're consuming that media. Yeah.
It's like I'm looking for them in the stuff that I consume, and therefore I'm kind of expecting it in my own story. And so because I'm approaching this like it's a police procedural, so there's a crime, obviously. Like that has to be integral to the opening and everything that's going on.
Big trouble. It's a very boring day at
the station. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's just start a police procedural and they're like doing paperwork at their desk. Hot shit. That,
see, that's a genre mashup of like Seinfeld versus police procedural. Wow. A show where nothing happens, right?
That sounds beautiful, MJ. That sounds...
Let's co-write it.
Yeah. But then like you have the crime that is the crux of this story, or a crux. It's kind of like the quintessential inciting incident. It doesn't have to be a murder, but it has to be a crime. And there are beats that you can hit in terms of the interactions between the investigator and forensics, the investigator and the dynamics at the police station, the other police officers or detectives or whomever, the captain or their superior, the chief, whoever they're interacting with that has more authority over them, the way in which the crime and the mystery starts to become more complicated as clues unfurl, and incorporating things like the autopsy and the interrogation and just these familiar beats that people have with these genres, such that they're like, it was like I was talking about earlier, the ways in which you can ground a reader with the familiar while introducing them to the unfamiliar. That is the best way to achieve that, because you can also use the familiar and, like you said, subvert it or twist it in certain ways. And in my case, like infect it with fungi in order to make it more evocative. And it's like, you can hit that beat, but you can also surprise people at the same time. Like, I can give you an interrogation, but if I tell you interrogation plus fungi, right, where does your mind go?
But that's what I was going to say. You did such a great job with that in Mushroom Blues, because you do hit those beats, right? We do have the autopsy. Yep. We do have the interrogation scene. You know, we do have the, you know, chase scene, or, you know, these things. Mm-hmm. But in all of those areas, I think you've done a really great job of taking those. So maybe that's the key, right? Taking those moments, taking the familiar trope beats or plot beats, and using those as your vehicle to make sure you're really injecting a double dose of that second genre in those areas.
Because it's like, you don't have to just do exactly what's come before, you know, like you can hit the beat with the thing that is familiar, but change it enough that it stands out in relation to your world. It stands out in sort of like the context of what came before, to say like, you can have an interrogation, but there are so many ways in which interrogations have become kind of rote and boring. How can you make an interrogation more interesting? And how does your world give you sort of, you know, like frameworks and sort of core components that can be incorporated into that beat and into that trope, such that you can expand it in such a way where not only is it fitting to the world that you've created, but it also satisfies the reader as well as enhancing their engagement and their investment in the story, to be like, okay, I got the interrogation, but holy fuck, that was stressful and surreal and weird.
Right. Got the interrogation and then some, right? Like that and additional element.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's great advice, to take those beats and look at your world that you've created. Yeah. Maybe that's the opportunity to, you know, we talked in our part one with you about, you know, when you spend all this time world building and you want to take all these really cool elements you've created and put them in, but how can you microdose them in? You know, that's the time when you take a look in your toolbox, your world building, you know, assemblage of things that you have that you haven't gotten to play with yet, or you haven't gotten to show in this way. I think that's great advice, that's where you kind of take that and you can thread those details in among those very familiar trope or plot beat elements.
Yeah, because it's using the trope and the beat to enrich your world. The two are working in conjunction to enrich each other, you know? And it's like, you don't have
symbiotic. Just like your fungals.
It's all symbiotic, man. There you go, MJ. You got this shit.
Get to the mushrooms.
You got the vocab. I even have a glossary in the fucking book. Like,
I know. You can just I love look it that so much, out. Though. Right. We'll all become like amateur mycologists after reading.
I want that to happen.
Yeah. You're like, no, but don't joke about that, MJ. That's what I want.
I really want that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's, you know, to close out this wonderful chat about genre mashups and smashing cool stuff together, what final words of advice or caution, if you have words of caution, do you have for writers that are looking to take two kind of disparate genres and smush them together in their work?
Yeah, I think the best thing that I can kind of lay out is not to, like the last episode, like not to force it. You know what I mean? Because if you are forcing it so much that you need to hit every specific beat of this genre, but that clashes with the other genre that you've mashed it up with. Or if you're too stuck in the idea that, like, I need this to be like a perfect representation of romance, but that ends up lessening the effects of the fantasy. I think it's very easy to fall into that trap, you know? Like in the case of Mushroom Blues, there were many instances where I was like, okay, I've got this police procedural stuff going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is actually beneficial for the story? And what is just stuff that I'm familiar with and almost like shoehorning it in because it's something that I'm familiar with? You don't have to completely replicate an entire genre and bring it together with another complete replication of another genre. You have to find the ways in which they weave together seamlessly, as opposed to forcing every aspect of one into the other. You have to bring out the most essential of each, such that the reader gets that satisfaction of expectation from the different elements, not necessarily that they're expecting absolutely everything, you know? Like in romantic comedy, you're like, you look at like any fucking Matthew McConaughey movie from like the early 2000s. there are such essential beats throughout his movies where the romance is so integral, but the comedy is also equally integral, and the two play off of each other. Like you have the moments where the relationship hits like a, like this breaking point and they split up, and Matthew McConaughey being like the comedic actor that he used to be, he's not so much of a comedic actor anymore, but those kinds of moments in like the romantic thread would be enhanced by how his comedic delivery or how the story incorporates comedy into that kind of symbiotic conjunction where they're able to feed into each other is so important. Because if they're clashing with each other, then your genre mashup is going to fail. Like in your books, like the heist works because of the contextual relationship that it has to the fantasy world. It doesn't feel shoehorned in. It doesn't feel like you forced it. It feels like, yeah, they would do a heist in this particular world at this particular time based on their particular motivations. And so if you try to just shove that shit in just because you think this genre is cool and this one is cool, it doesn't necessarily mean that every aspect of each is going to work with the other. So you need to really like think about, what do I love about this genre and why? And do that for whichever other genres you want to mix it with. And hone that in. hone that into the things that you love about those particular genres, not necessarily everything that everyone loves about those particular genres. Because if you're trying to hit all the beats for everyone else, it's going to be too burdensome for the story to handle. And so for me, like with Mushroom Blues, with the police procedural elements, with the murder mystery elements, I hit the beats that I wanted to hit. Not necessarily that they are a comprehensive incorporation of every fucking beat that exists within those genres. I hit the beats that I wanted to hit, that I needed to hit, the ones that served the story and the expectations of the audience at the same time, while also being able to incorporate it more fully with the fungal aspects and you know, like the gangsters and the crime and all this kind of stuff that is part of the world. But if I just went too far into police procedural, there would be more opportunities for the pacing to falter. There would be more opportunities. Yeah, we lose some of the
magic, right? And yeah. I don't mean magic in terms of like, oh, like fantasy magic, but like literal magic, right? Like the secret sauce. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's very easy to fall into that trap. And I think that authors just need to be wary of why they're picking a particular genre, what they love about that particular genre. If you're picking a genre that you don't love, then fucking stop.
Like, wait, why are you doing that? Well, and why are you doing that? That's a trick that a lot of people could fall for too, right? Yeah. Exactly. Like, oh, this, you know,
I'm going to write romanticy, even though I don't like romance. Because it sells.
And it's so painful for me because I wish I could write that, but I know it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be organic to me if I were to write it, because it's not something I particularly personally enjoy. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's great advice to just, it kind of all comes back to, you know, that critical advice of writing what you want to read, of letting the story breathe, of letting it be organic to you and to what the story needs to be.
Just like world building, don't burden the reader with too much exposition, you know, because there you could just not necessarily info dump them, but you can just dump a fat load of tropes and beats on a reader as well. Like
plot dump them, if you will.
Yeah. So you can fall into that trap as well. And I think with genre mashups, you have to walk the fine line between what works for you about the genres that you are working with. Even like going beyond that to like, you know, like grimdark, the mood, or to the aesthetics, or to the particular passion that you have in life that you're bringing into this. Walk the fine line between what do I love about this thing and hone it down into what are the essential elements of that could benefit this story, as opposed to overburdening it.
Awesome. That's a great note to leave us on, I think, because that's it for our mini masterclass. Woo. And our two-part spotlight with my wonderful co-host, Adrian. Yay. I'm so excited that we got to chat and that I got to put you in the hot seat and talk about, you know, what makes your stories tick and get some great insights from you on how to mash up our lovely genres like you did in Mushroom Blues. And
I feel like people probably, this is like a good opportunity for people to get to know me better, because I'm not usually speaking so much, you know.
Well, that's, you know, we did, it is kind of funny. We did an intro, you know, the interview with me at the beginning when I first came on as co-host to introduce me to everybody. But yeah, this is really everyone's first real intro to you.
After like two and a half years doing this
podcast. Yeah, right. You guys have been friends with Adrian for all this time and you're now just learning. Yeah. Well, if you contribute to our Patreon, $10 or more a month, you can hear even more from Adrian with an exclusive reading of chapter 3 of Mushroom Blues. And I mean, also if you contribute to our Patreon, you get all other kinds of cool stuff like our bonus episodes and more author readings, all kinds of good stuff.
Where MJ and I just like
It gets real chaotic sometimes. It's so fun though. Yeah, those are really fun episodes. Perfect. Well, Adrian, where can everybody find you online? Keep up with, you know, obviously, as we mentioned last episode, they can find you here every week. But where can they follow your particular books? Keep up to date on what you're publishing, what you're working on.
Yeah. So Adrian M. Gibson on all the socials and adrianmgibson.com, where, yeah, you can just like, everything's kind of organized in one central place. And there's also an online store, and you can get some cool merch for Mushroom Blues or other things as well. Yeah, you can pick up Mushroom Blues now in ebook or paperback. That's on Amazon, all over the world, wherever you are. And I would really appreciate y'all support my debut novel. And you can also look forward to the hardcover, which is out on April 2nd, as well as the audiobook, which I am narrating, is on April 16th. You can also check out the official Mushroom Blues soundtrack, which was composed and produced by Spore. And that is available to buy digitally on Bandcamp. You can also get the limited edition cassette tape, or you can pick it up on Apple Music. You can stream it on Spotify, all the usual places, but I hope you'll check that out. I also have a Spotify playlist for Mushroom Blues, which has 40 tracks, one track per chapter, if you want to really immerse yourself even deeper. It includes the songs from the soundtrack sprinkled through there, but there's just a lot of the stuff that I listened to while writing this book, and music that has been very inspirational for me and sort of representative of the mood and atmosphere of Mushroom Blues. So
amazing. Yeah, everybody check all that stuff out. Go to Adrian's website, check out the soundtrack. Also, you know, grab yourself a copy of Mushroom Blues, but don't forget, go to your local library and ask them to order a copy to keep in the library. That's a great way that is free for you to support the author, but gets a sale and helps, you know, get the book out there more. So that's always a great thing to do. You can follow SFF Addicts if you aren't already. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, and Blue Sky at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me all those places at MJ Coon Books. And now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we will see you next time back to our normal format on SFF Addicts.